You look terrible. Once you leave, I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
Too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make them an offer they can't refuse.
What's that all about? That's apparently famous, that line, hey?
It's very famous. It's integral to the Godfather trilogy, in fact.
There you go. Josh Nelson, our film reviewer, is in the studio for the next half hour, taking your calls on 1-300-222-774. On films, classic films, you've somehow, I like the music, failed to see. And that's because I quietly went to him this week, and said, "Hi, you know I'm presenting this week? Yeah. You know I haven't seen The Godfather." And he said, let's talk about that, you weirdo. So we'll take your calls. We've actually got a few texts from people saying, "Oh, you're the only other person in the world, Patricia, who also hasn't seen The Godfather." No, I reckon there's secretly many of us. Now, you saw it remastered something. It was sunny, I remember, and you still went. And
I did. I spent 9.5 hours last weekend at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image.
9.5 hours.
Yep, well, not including the breaks and the intermissions and so on. So that was my Saturday and Sunday taken care of last weekend, and I'm pretty glad I did. We'll talk about the third one maybe later and why I have reservations about that one. But if people haven't actually seen the Godfather films before, confession time, this is probably the best opportunity to see these films in the most remarkable formats. These are brand new 35mm prints that have been restored. All the way from Los Angeles, they've come out from the Academy Restoration, and they had their very first run through a projector last weekend at Acme. So they're showing again this Saturday. That is The Godfather 1 is showing on Saturday, and then Godfather 2 and 3 back-to-back on Sunday. So if you have no interest in sport or you're not busy on Saturday after the grand final, I suggest you get down to Acme because the prints are extraordinary in terms of how they look, but more importantly, the sound too is absolutely remarkable. Mm. And you know, if people are mourning the loss of celluloid, then this is a wonderful time to get in touch with that nostalgia because you know, these films really are about nostalgia as well. So it's kind of quite fitting that they've made their way back to 35mm.
1-300-222-774. If you want to share your favourite moment from the Godfather films, it's not just films. It's not just if you've missed the films that you need to call us. You can call us if you've seen the film and you really like the film. I just haven't seen the film. Who cares about me? I just haven't seen the film. What other? Is there any films? I mean, Josh, you are a big. You do film. Film is your thing, right?
It is.
Are there any classic films you've failed to see?
So let's open the shame file. Actually, let's have confession time. That's very Catholic. It's very mm-hmm. Godfather. There's probably two Hollywood ones that keep coming back, and that's Lawrence of Arabia.
Uh-huh.
Never seen that. Mm-hmm. And Gone with the Wind. Shock horror.
See, now I can mock you. Yeah, I've seen Gone with the Wind more than around 5 times at least.
Really?
Probably more, but 5 times I can remember, yeah.
See, I have little interest in seeing Gone with the Wind. I know that's a horrible thing to say from a film person. Lawrence of Arabia, the reason I haven't seen that is because I don't want to see it on a small screen. I keep hearing it's a big screen film, so I keep waiting for maybe that's something the Academy should do. It should send out restored 35mm prints of Lawrence of Arabia to Acme for a future
lobby
season.
Lobby on 774 Drive. Well, let's get back to the Godfather films and why you thought it was worth spending, you know, quite a beautiful day in a city that doesn't always offer us beautiful days. So what I see is a high-risk strategy, really, saying, you know, I'm not going to go with the sun, I'm going to go with sitting indoors and watching these films, given you've seen them before. But what is it about this film that you find so mesmerising?
Look, the first two in particular, the fact that they're about nostalgia and they represent a moment in American filmmaking of that golden era of the 1970s that was sort of daring, that was character-driven, that stylistically was forming a kind of a bridge between sort of the European movements of the 60s and the experimentalism there and the way in which that was integrated into narrative cinema. But, you know, that captures that perfect moment or that turning point in Hollywood cinema where, particularly for the first Godfather film, you have an established actor, Marlon Brando, represents that kind of the high point of the studio system in the 50s, mm. with this cast of young up-and-coming actors like Al Pacino, yeah. Diane Keaton, Robert Duvall, James Caan. In fact, most of the studios didn't want those guys. I mean, Pacino was a sort of a no-name at that point. And even for the sequel, Robert De Niro was an unknown commodity. And their performance style and the way they carry off the film and the script of the film is so subtle. You know, they're renowned as long, epic films. And yet, for both the first and second films, it's the quickest 3 hours and 3.5 hours I can remember sitting in a cinema and watching a film.
Well, that's the test, isn't it? That's the test of a good film, not to feel the time. And actually, look, I'm going to recommend Gone with the Wind to you because you don't feel the time with Gone with the Wind either. It's just such an epic, amazing film. Lucy from Queenscliff joins us. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, on this beautiful day.
It is so gorgeous. Now, tell me, you're from an Italian family, so this is a thing for you.
Well, it is. It's a real thing, and it started when I was really young. So my great-uncle, who would sit at the head of the table and drink lots of red wine, every Christmas and Easter, just about after lunch, you'd hear this voice from the back of the house saying, "Put the Godfather on." And so we would sit, 6 years old, the horse in the bed, everything. We would sit there, we'd watch it from the time I was six, probably till the time I was 12 or 13 when we were just all over it. But that was our Christmas and Easter afternoon watching The Godfather.
How many times do you think you've seen The Godfather, Lucy?
Oh, at least 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you can kind of recite lines from it?
No, look, I was too young and the horror of it all and, you know, it was all, I didn't understand
the concept.
I
just want to watch Aladdin.
Yeah, well, I was too old for Aladdin too, you know. But it was amazing. It just sort of like, because I think he sort of thought he was the godfather of the family and that was his movie and, you know, he was the head of the family and he had to watch the movie he wanted to watch and... We're all subject to it.
Thanks for the call, Lucy. Look, there are a lot of people who like to think of themselves as godfather-like figures, there's no doubt.
Well, one of the criticisms of the film when it first came out was that it glorified the mafia. It glorified this idea of the gangster. And I think it's interesting because why the film is so successful and I think the appeal of it so many years later and why it's considered this great masterpiece and why it works, I think, is because it focuses on the family. And the fact that they're in the mafia is almost secondary because the family conflicts are what drives the narrative and the character conflicts. Most of the scenes are between one or two characters in sort of dramatic settings and they just happen to be in a kind of a mafia setting. And, you know, there's very little violence in the film. I mean, people remember, like, the horse's head in the bed or the incredible sequence towards the end of the film where that cross cuts between a communion sequence and then all the other heads of the families being kind of bumped off. But really, what for the bulk of the film, it's about family conflict and people can identify with that, and not just Italian families but any families. And I think that's the strength of particularly the first two films and this nostalgia of the past. And the film, these films trade off the good old days and the immigrant experience and the idea of the homeland of Sicily and that, you know, if we can just get back to that. And because the film really charts the decline of America post-World War II, and that's what's fascinating about the Pacino character, Michael, who begins the first film as this young, fresh-faced, naive, I'm not going to be part of this family, and gets kind of blood on his hands and ends up becoming the corrupt figure that he never wanted to be. And it really charts that kind of decline of America, you know, post-World War II through the 70s.
But also that concept of your... I haven't seen it, but based on what you say, that concept of your family following you around. It's very hard to step out.
That responsibility, yeah, and the father's shadow. And it works so well because Marlon Brando is so captivating in that first film. I mean, he's, you know, for all the kind of jokes about the cotton wool and the cheek buds and the kind of way in which he inserts orange peel in his mouth and talks, kind of mumbles, you know, he is such a strong presence on screen. And he's the perfect patriarchal figure in that way. And that's why he's this kind of idealized figure as well. I mean, the first two films are really remarkable. And the sad thing is, the third one, look, if you've never seen the third one, it's not a great film. People have tried to resuscitate this somehow. But, if you know, where it falls down is it tries to do the family thing, but also instills this ridiculous subplot about the Vatican. It tries to kind of have this grand narrative, which is completely unnecessary and really doesn't work.
So did you want to walk out in the last part of your...
I was really hoping I could go in and reappraise it and say, you know, there's something here that the critical reputation of it as a bit of a dog is unjustified. But no, from the script through the performances through the plot, it is a real letdown.
We're talking, of course, with Josh Nelson, our film reviewer, 1-300-222-774. Another one from the shame file. Never seen any of the Star Wars. Kathy of Narre Warren admits.
Well, I wouldn't bother with the prequels, but the first three are requisite viewing, I would have thought.
I have actually seen Star Wars.
Okay, so there you go.
I do. I don't have entirely shame around that. Another one, on my gravestone I want written, never saw Gone with the Wind. Unfortunately, did see The Wedding Singer. I like The Wedding Singer.
So do I, actually.
That's just me.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
You're with Patricia Karvelas.
12 minutes to 5 on 774, and I'm joined by Josh Nelson, our film reviewer who has endured about 9.5 hours of The Godfather and apparently loved almost every minute. I do urge you to see Gone with the Wind. It really is quite a beautiful Civil War, you know, the South and the Yankees.
I know, it's a lot of drama.
There's good dresses in it. There's unrequited love. I mean, it's got it all.
See, I already know how it ends, though, now. You know, it's one of those films that pops up in all those film documentaries and, you know, the frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's quite a good line, actually, as far as catchphrases go.
It's just so heartbreaking, too. I was really involved all those times I watched it. Yes, favourite moment of The Godfather, 1-300-222-774. I've got a text here, 51 years old, stuck in a plane to London for 20 hours in August this year, decided to watch The Godfather 1, 2 and 3 on the airplane movie channel. Time just flew and I finally watched them all, from Lisa in Kensington. That is actually a useful exercise.
Well, passing time it is, but I'm not sure Francis Ford Coppola would approve of his two masterpieces being watched on such a tiny screen.
Not a fan of the mini screen.
No,
I don't mind the mini screen.
I don't care. There's so much wonderful detail in these prints. In fact, there's some, well, not quite in jokes, but there's some nice references there. There's a key scene early on in The Godfather where Marlon Brando is buying oranges from his local grocer, and in the background is a boxing poster for a match involving Jake LaMotta, who of course was the figure of Raging Bull, played by Robert De Niro, who would go on to play the Brando figure in the sequel. So there you go. There's some little film trivia for you.
I like trivia. Josh from Hampton Park joins us. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how you going?
We're well. You have seen The Godfather.
Yes, I have. I've seen it multiple times. And I just wanted to say something to Josh. In regards to the third part of The Godfather, I was quite disappointed. But in saying that, the last scene at the Opera House, I've actually been to that Opera House in Sicily, it's magnificent. And that is one of my favourite scenes with Al Pacino, the way that he just cries and screams when his daughter dies.
There's a spoiler for you, but then again, the audience has
We've pretty much given it
24
away.
Years.
In fact, I'm never going to see it now.
It is a very operatic ending, and look, as much as that scene is probably one of the best in the third film, it comes back to the first two films are so operatic just in terms of their structure and style, and the third, I think this is really endemic of what some of the problems with the third one is, it becomes a literal opera, and he has to sort of set this thing in a literal opera, and even to the point where we have characters who then act out on the steps of the opera house what's just taken place on stage, in case the audience didn't quite get the link. I found it really frustrating the third one, but look, I'll say it again, if you've never seen the third one, you're never going to see a better print than what's showing on the weekends.
You're really selling that. I can see that.
You want us all there.
David from Frankston.
Yeah, so I've seen the Godfathers and I thought they were terrific. But the third one was a bit, it didn't have the oomph as the first two. But anyway, the reason I'm ringing is I've never seen Rocky 1 or Rocky 2.
Mm.
And the reason is that I was a taxi driver years ago and I picked up a passenger in Swanston Street when you could still drive up and down there. And the chap said to me, he said, hello, yada, yada, and whatever. And I said, he said he'd just been to the movies. And I said, what did you see? And he said, mate, I saw Rocky 2. He said, this is really good. He wins this one.
That's hilarious.
And I promise you, it's true.
That's hilarious. Thank you, David. Oh, there you go. There you go. That's pretty funny. Maze, now I want to get to the next film.
Yeah,
we've got to get to your next film. I feel like we've neglected it as we've focused so much on The Godfather.
Well, this is probably not a classic that people necessarily will have to put in their shame files in years to come. This is The Maze Runner. It's based on, from what I can gather, a very popular YA novel that came out in 2007. The film is, I guess, a sort of a young adult sci-fi post-apocalyptic film. It begins with a young man who emerges from an underground elevator into this sort of rural setting, into a group of other kind of young men. He has no memory and he's surrounded on all sides by this gigantic maze.
Wow, can we hear the trailer?
Day one, Greenie. Rise and shine.
What is this place?
Can you tell me your name?
I can't remember anything.
Who put us here? We don't know.
What's out there?
The maze.
Every morning when those doors open, the runners look for a way out. No one has ever survived a night in the maze. What happens to them?
We don't belong here.
I think it's time we find out what we're really up against.
Everything started changing the moment you showed up.
Josh, I'm adequately freaked out. Should I be?
Not necessarily. The trailer gives away the basic plot details and the plot points right there, and it is a, I guess there's a sort of a social allegory there about, you know, actually I've heard people refer to this quite lazily as a sort of a Lord of the Flies style film, and I think that's a bit of a mistake, because it's really almost, if you can imagine, Lord of the Flies has taken place and you've had this sort of chaos and the social order has now started to restore itself, and then you have a solitary figure who comes into that and then begins a conflict. So the kind of debauchery and the collapse of civilization has already taken place, because we find out at a certain point in the film that these other all males, all sort of teens, have been living in this, what they call the glade, the area in the middle of the maze, for 3 or 4 years. I liked the build-up to this film. The first couple of acts are really promising, because the audience is put on side with this young character, and the details about the world in which these characters live and what's taken place come out sort of gradually. So it has a kind of a nice level of intrigue within it. You know, I probably would have walked out of this film thinking, you know what, that was a pretty decent, you know, sort of Hunger Games style narrative. The last 10 minutes of this film are so abysmal and, like, almost bordering on Austin Powers-style parody.
Really?
That I kind of... It was sort of jaw-droppingly, like, what has just happened at the end of this film? And I'm not sure whether
Who stole my film?
Yeah, it almost felt like... And having not read the books, I'm not sure whether it was a case of, oops, there's all these plot points that we didn't mention and we have to throw them all in at the very end, or whether it was an attempt to kind of lead into the sequel or what it was. But things go very wrong in the last 10 minutes, to the point where I think all the good work that had been done up until that point was pretty much spoiled for me, which is a real shame. And it's just this ridiculous exposition dump, and then a character is suddenly there who shouldn't be there, and it's like, oh, look, there's a button here. I'm going to press this button, and look, thank you. You're going to explain everything for me. And then the final scene actually makes no sense in the context of what's just taken place. So it's a real betrayal of the narrative. And look, who knows whether it was a case of the first-time director syndrome, because it is a debut feature from this director, Wes Ball, or whether it was studio intervention, or whatever has taken place, kind of spoils what had a lot of promise. So, look, I think it's an interesting film in terms of school holiday fare for young adults. It's probably one of the better ones on offer. But, yeah, the ending
so
really...
Solved if you sort of left 10 minutes early?
Yeah, because it kills all the intrigue, and that's what this film really had going for it, this kind of nice level of intrigue, the sort of that wonderful sci-fi kind of concept set up of, you know, do we believe this world? Who's running the show? The kind of the puppet master
syndrome.
It's
that neat little Hollywood problem, isn't it? It's, oh, let's all just explain everything away and make it all end nicely.
And it just kills the drama. You'd think they would learn.
It is. Josh Nelson, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Josh Nelson, our film reviewer. And, of course, if you want to read what he has to write, and he does write stuff, go to www.filmology.com, and that's a PH.